The Rebel Capitalist Show, Episode 25, Coronavirus Deep Dive with Eric Townsend, Part 2 of 2.
Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
So let's go back to the macro really quick here. And have you got any idea, or have you been thinking about how this might affect markets?
Yeah, there's one specific scenario that I've been predicting, which let me just look at. Well, it was starting to happen, and it is. It's in stocks, as we've been speaking. Just in the time we've been recording this, George, on Tuesday morning, stocks have rallied to new all-time highs after being up tremendously overnight. Why is that happening? It's happening because of the coronavirus, which seems completely counterintuitive. What's going on is Zhang Nashan said that his model indicates that China's case growth should peak in the next couple of weeks. The officially reported numbers out of China are clearly showing that a peak is already in. If you look at the chart, if you're a person used to looking at stock charts or something, it's like, oh, that thing topped, blow off top, numbers are going downhill, and there's a clear trend downhill. Okay, it's all better. Well, dude, they ran out of test kits. That's what happened. So even if China is peaking, which we don't know yet, wait a minute, what about all of the contagion to the rest of the world that hasn't even started to grow? People aren't even getting sick yet around the world. And you know, the cruise ships are showing us that people are getting sick elsewhere in the world, and particularly when they're confined in close quarters, like on a cruise ship, a lot of people are getting sick, and they're getting sick very quickly. So maybe we're starting to see the first signs of this really spreading outside of China. But the news out of China is case count is peaked. Government officials are saying the official statistics clearly indicate a case, a peak in the reported statistics. And Zhang Nashan, who's a very well-respected guy because he was one of the people who discovered SARS, is saying his model predicts that if it hasn't peaked already, it will in the next couple of weeks. Based on that, what we're getting is the market is perceiving that the news is basically all clear. Foxconn people got workers going back to work in Shenzhen. Now, they only sent 10% of the workers back to Shenzhen. And to come out of Lunar New Year and only have 10% of your workforce go back to work says to me that there's still a really serious problem there. But the way the market is interpreting this, I won't be at all surprised if stocks rally further from here, and not just rally, but rally on reported news that the reason they're rallying is because the coronavirus is all over with and it's ending now and it's not a big deal. What we don't know yet, and again, I'm not saying it's for sure, I'm saying it's we don't know yet, is this just going to be the China wave maybe is peaking and the rest of the world wave hasn't even started yet, except on cruise ships where it has started and it looks really bad based on what we're seeing there. So I think the first thing that I expect is markets will probably recover both commodity and stock prices from the oversold condition they had. Certainly stocks already are at new all-time highs as we're speaking. It looked this morning like crude oil. I'm just glancing over at my charts here. You can't see in the rest of my office. I've got charts everywhere. As I look at crude oil futures, they were breaking out above their 5 and 8 day moving averages this morning. They're back below the 5 and 8s as I'm speaking, and it looks like they're headed lower. RBOB gasoline is headed lower. Stocks are headed higher. I won't be surprised if at some point we get a false sense of all clear and everything, including oil prices, rallies back up. We retrace maybe half of the big move down that we've seen. Crude oil, copper, and iron ore have all taken a major hit on this. I wouldn't be surprised to see relief rallies in all of those assets because people are misinterpreting the data. The news that we are getting is the case count may be peaking if we can believe the Chinese government in China. The rest of the world pandemic hasn't even started, and we don't know if it's going to start. there's a lot of good reason to suspect that it could. And, you know, this whole bit about Asian people being more susceptible to it, first of all, that's brand new kind of unproven science. And second of all, how much more susceptible? A little bit more susceptible or a lot more susceptible? Nobody knows. I certainly don't know about ACE2 receptors and in cell walls and so forth. The people who do know all about that seem to be saying it's still completely unknown. There's a theory there that seems like a solid theory that has yet to be proven out. Studies need to be done. These things normally take months and months and months, then they go through peer review and so forth. Obviously, the pace of effort is accelerated, but we don't know yet what the answer is going to be. So I won't be surprised if there is a false sense of relief that leads to a rally in commodity prices. And I was going to make the same prediction for stock prices. It happened already. And we've seen it very consistently. The rally off of what was it, 3218 or so that S&P futures got down to. I'm just glancing at my S&P chart down here. A lot of that was driven by a perception that, you know, that everything was better about the coronavirus. It was actually the cure news, I think, is what got us off of that low. It was when the Gilead remdesivir is going to cure everything. Well, wait a minute. That was never going to cure everything. It was supposedly a drug that was very effective, maybe, in treating something that we don't know how many people are going to get. We don't know if it's going to overwhelm the entire world's medical facilities. The fact that there's a drug that might help in fighting something that can't be stopped shouldn't cause the market to recover. But the market wants to recover. Why is the market so eager to recover to new all-time highs? I think it's what you said earlier, George. Everybody knows that no matter what, we're going to get a lot of central bank stimulus behind this. Once the crisis is over, whenever that is, there's going to be a lot of stimulus. It's going to drive equity markets higher at that time. I think that there's still a big move down still to come before the big move up. But I think there's maybe a little move up first on a false sense of relief. Then we start to see the rest of this play out around the rest of the world. You get a really big panic move down when everybody says, oh my God, it's not just China, it's the whole world. And then that panic move goes as far as it can go. And then people start to realize, wait a minute, central banks are going to just open the liquidity spigot as wide as they can. The fire hose is you know, spraying dollars at maximum intensity. Right. I don't think that can save crude oil, because if you get the whole world panicking so nobody wants to travel and nobody's willing to get on an airliner, crude oil is going to get hit no matter what, no matter what happens in terms of monetary policy. It's entirely possible that bad news is the good news, or bad is the new good doctrine takes over here, and we only get a temporary spike down in stocks, and everybody realizes this has to be the biggest stimulus yet. And, you know, the actual realization of a true global pandemic drives the S&P 500 to 4,000 or something. I mean, it's ridiculous to even think something like that could be happening, but that's the central bank driven market world that we live in these days.
Yeah, so let's go back to commodities really quick, because I know you follow the oil market as closely as anyone I've ever seen. And I've been looking at commodities recently, just because from what I can tell, they're one of the very few things in the world right now that are actually cheap. But it sounds like they may, according to your opinion, may be getting even cheaper. Has all the bad news been priced in, or is there a lot more downside? And if there is a lot more downside, could that potentially be a buying opportunity in the future?
Well, George, what we've seen so far is that copper, crude oil, and iron ore have definitely reacted very negatively to this event. Now, what a lot of experts are saying, people who are well-respected in those markets are, okay, boys, this is the bottom, because we are on key support levels in those commodities. And the view that's being expressed is, okay, the dummies are still panicking, but it's time to buy the dip, because these things have moved down substantially. They're on key support levels. There's a lot of good reason to expect that this is the bottom and it's time to buy those commodities. Here's what I think. That's probably the most common consensus view among experts in those commodity trading areas. I disagree quite strongly with that. First, I think that they could very well be right. In fact, I think it's very likely that they'll be proven right in the short term. And the reason is, as we discussed earlier, I think that there is a significant rally coming on the false perception that everything's all better. And it may be not a false perception. It might be a realistic, accurate perception that things are getting better in China and that the worst is over in China. We may be close to that point. What the market is absolutely not discounting is, what if a global pandemic outside of China hasn't even started yet, but is about to? So I think that this is the bottom and it's time for the market to reverse direction and move up will likely be proven right in the short term. But I think that there's a lower low still to come. And I mean a lot lower low. That's if and only if it turns out that my worst fears are confirmed and this gets worse before it gets better. And I think it's actually going to get better first in the sense of perception. Then what's going to happen? And it could, you know, with this new news about 24-day incubation periods, could take a month before it happens. But I think at some point we're going to be breathing that sigh of relief that the worst is over in China and the world's recovering coronavirus will soon be forgotten. And then all of a sudden you see an explosion of cases and deaths outside the United States. I say that could be a whole month away. Well, gee, we're already starting to see it on a couple of cruise ships, people confined in close quarters, a lot of contagion there. So we'll see what happens. But as far as what I'm doing, I'm hedging here with options. I'm buying puts on crude oil futures. I think there's a very good chance of crude oil going substantially lower. So I'm buying 50 strike puts, which is basically the at the money put right now. I'm not going short crude oil here. And the reason is I think there could be a face ripper of a rally if this false signal of all clear, Chinese workers are going back to work, everything's better. We don't know if everything's better until we find out whether or not there's going to be a global pandemic outside of China. And we just don't know that. And it might be a few weeks before we get a solid indication of whether that's really happening or not. Although I would say WHO changing their tune recently suggests maybe it is starting to happen a little sooner than I might have thought. Ultimately, though, if we do get an outside of China significant pandemic, market has not even begun to price that in, I think all of those commodities go lower. And eventually there will be a very viable bottom, because you know this thing is going to be followed by a huge amount of central bank stimulus. Eventually, we're going to need to recover the global economy. Even if you, worst case, if the China Academy of Sciences a report proves correct, the only way to contain this thing is to quarantine people for weeks at a time. So just as China has already done, other countries will be forced to impose quarantines where everybody is just required to stay at home for 3 weeks or a month or something. That would probably be the worst imaginable case. If that were to happen all across the world, it would have just disastrous effects on the global economy. But hey, then eventually it passes. Some people die. This is not going to wipe out most of humanity or anything like that. It looks like maybe 1% is the fatality rate. But still, if tens or hundreds of millions of people get infected, 1% is still a whole lot of people. It's a really big deal. In any event, the economic effects at some point will bottom. And when they do, I would expect a V-shaped recovery. You know, this is one of those panic situations where it gets bad, 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 and worse. And then all of a sudden it's, wow, okay, it's over. And everything starts to recover. I think that point is still well into the future. That is based on speculation. I don't know, but my gut feeling is everybody's assuming this is over before they should be. I think there's way too much complacency in the market. So for now, I am hedging with puts on crude oil. If we see that face ripper of a rally, particularly if it gets back above, let me just look at my crude oil chart, 21-day moving average is around $54 now. I wouldn't start outright selling crude oil futures unless we got back to $54. 100-day moving average is around 56.17. So in that range between 54 and 56, I'd start being tempted to outright short the crude oil market if I still think we're headed towards there being some kind of pandemic outside of China. If it turns out that it really is contained entirely inside of China, maybe somehow this ACE2 receptor thing truly means that people who are not of Asian descent are just not susceptible. I think that's very wishful thinking. I don't think it's going to work out that way. If it did, still, how long is it going to take the world to recover from the supply chain disruptions? I mean, we can't even get antibiotics and pharmaceuticals that are made in China now. And they're sole source, apparently. I didn't know that. Even the Indian antibiotics buy their ingredients from China in order to make those antibiotics. I just learned that from Chris Martinson's video. So I don't know, but I don't think it's over.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. So you're data dependent, just like the Fed, right?
Definitely data dependent, but hedging right now and buying puts on crude oil futures, and we'll consider the outright short on a good healthy bounce.
Yeah. So what you're talking about right there is kind of shorter term, midterm trading. If I'm someone that's more of a long-term investor, just buy and hold in the commodities, I think that, you know, in 5 years, 10 years, it's something that I want to, that could go up in price. So it's kind of a long-term speculation. How would you be looking at it differently?
Well, in that case, I think the opportunity is, you know, we're setting up a buy the dip moment. Is the buy the dip moment right now? Some people would argue that it is, that it's already passed. Last night, which was a low in crude oil at 49 spot something, that was it. That would be true if we don't see this grow outside of China. With the way the WHO is acting in the last couple of days, I really don't think that's likely. So I don't think the low is in yet. Okay. I think that the low is very likely to be a lot lower than the current low. I don't have a specific number in mind for crude oil prices, but I think that when this is played out to the point where the worst of the news is in, where the effects on the global economy have really been felt and everybody is panicked, I think there will be a tremendous buying opportunity in commodities at that point. There should be one in stocks too, but do the stocks even sell off? That's another question that we'd have to ask.
Yeah. You know, I know you're long-term very bullish on oil. Well, I mean long-term, I mean probably outside of 5 years. I know your position on gold, very bullish on gold as well. But, you know, I've never heard you talk about agriculture. Do you have any opinions on that?
You know, I don't really have any strong opinions. Certainly, we've got a global population problem. We're, what is it, almost 8 billion people on the planet now. At some point, there's not enough agriculture to grow around, to go around. And I think particularly the biotech companies that are innovating new ways to create new efficiencies where you can feed more people with less acres of farmland and so forth. There's a lot of opportunity in that space. It's not something that I understand well enough to really think I'm an investor on. I can say, macro standpoint, I think agriculture ought to do well in the face of demographics and growing world population in coming years, but I don't really have a strong view on it. In the case of crude oil, I have a much, much stronger view there. We're going to have a moonshot in crude oil prices after the shale revolution has fizzled out. And I don't think it's quite done yet, but we're getting into the seventh or eighth inning, at least, in this shale revolution. Once the shale has played out, you're back to very deep water, Arctic deep water, really expensive forms of oil exploration to find the next marginal barrel. And I think prices go way up. And there was an excellent article, I don't have a link here for it, but there was an article written recently saying, you know, it's not an absence of available oil we need to worry about. It's an absence of available credit that's going to change the dynamics. What really made the shale revolution possible was a mountain of easy money liquidity coming from central bank policy. When we don't have that mountain of junk bond capital ready to support the next wave of the shale revolution, all of a sudden, you know, these guys have to actually make money with these companies before they can get financing, and the game changes. Right. So I think that eventually oil prices go a whole lot higher. But the thing is, there's no limit to how low they can go if we really had a situation where the kind of lockdown of entire cities that has been necessary in China, and my sense is it has been absolutely necessary, it was the only way they could contain this epidemic viral outbreak. If that has to happen across the rest of the world, it's just unthinkable how low in the very short term commodity prices could go. It will be a buy the dip opportunity, but of course, then you've got a huge, very steep contango at that point. So it's hard to buy that dip efficiently.
Yeah. Do you see green energy having any effect on the demand side of the equation for oil in the long term?
Oh, green energy is super duper important, and it will have a very, very important effect. The problem in my mind is we haven't grown up yet and really taken green energy seriously. And what I mean by that, see, just for a brief moment, the people who identify as green energy guys will like me because I said that. Let's give it a few more seconds to let it set in before I tell them. When we're ready to get grown up and seriously take the environment seriously, take our planet seriously, then the grown-ups will recognize that they're the center of green energy strategy has to be a nuclear renaissance. And I don't mean the same kind of dangerous, inefficient, uranium-fired nuclear reactors that melted down in Fukushima and Three Mile Island and so forth. We've got to get to a new generation of nuclear technology, which is safer. But the ultimate green energy source is nuclear. And a lot of green energy guys are not ready to recognize that yet. Someday we'll get there. I think it's going to take an oil crisis before we open our minds to that, because so many people's minds are so closed to nuclear energy being the most environmentally clean form of energy that there is.
Yeah, so uranium might be something interesting in the future. Okay, Eric, so let's take it
back. Thorium, not just uranium. We got to get to the liquid fluoride thorium reactor being commercialized. That's going to be a really important milestone. Unfortunately, it's not going to happen anytime soon.
Oh, so that's something that produces nuclear without uranium.
That's right. It's a completely different nuclear energy production mechanism. And the guy to follow, if you want to learn all about this, is named Kirk Sorensen. And NASA scientist, done a lot of work on this. But the gist of it, what a lot of people don't understand, is the nuclear energy industry evolved during the Cold War when priorities were different. The fact that a byproduct of nuclear power generation is that it creates weapons-grade plutonium as a side effect of the nuclear reaction. That was by design. They chose uranium as the fuel for nuclear power plants because it produced weapons-grade fissionable material that could be used to build nuclear bombs with. That was one of the things they were trying to accomplish. Thorium doesn't create any nuclear proliferation. It doesn't have a byproduct of the reaction being plutonium and so forth. And it also can't melt down because it's a different chemical process. The way the thorium reactor works is you just turn it off and it there's no need to keep the pumps going in order to cool the core the way a uranium reactor works. Hmm. So it's inherently many times safer. The crazy thing in this story, it sounds like it's just science fiction. It's probably not proven and it's just some idea on a drawing board. No, they've built one of these things and they got it working in like 1954 or something like that, long, long time ago. Then they subsequently decided it doesn't produce weapons-grade plutonium. It's no good for our Cold War objectives, and they forgot about it. We need to get back to that, but it would be a sea change for the nuclear power industry. I don't know that much about it. Kirk Sorensen is the guy, if you want to Google, who's done a bunch of YouTube videos and TED Talks about fluoride, about the thorium, what was it? LFTR, liquid fluoride thorium reactor. LFTR is the acronym to Google.
Okay, so let's take it back to the stock market. And how does this play out there? We talked about commodities, and I'm sure a lot of people are in the market right now via a 401k or an IRA, a lot of the average Joes that watch my channel. So what type of forecast do you have for that?
This is really hard, George, because you know it started as a joke in finance when people said bad is the new good, and it's become more than just a joke. What happens is markets anticipate what bad news events are going to cause central banks to create more liquidity. And they know that that liquidity tends to go into boosting asset prices. So when we get bad economic news, it used to cause stock prices to go down. Now it causes stock prices to go up because bad economic news means central banks are going to stimulate the economy by conjuring more money out of thin air and using it to buy bonds on the open market. Those bonds are bought from institutional investors, puts money in their pockets. What do? They buy more risk assets, pushes up the price of stocks. So I think that there's almost certain to be a panic down reaction in the stock market if and when the news breaks that this coronavirus thing has gone global and it's not just in China and that we're really seeing a global pandemic breaking out. Now, again, before anybody puts any words in my mouth, I didn't predict that that's certain to happen. I don't even know whether that's likely to happen. What I do know is it's a very realistic possibility. It is a non-zero probability, and the market is discounting as if it were a zero probability.
Right.
If and only if that happens, I got to believe there's some panic in the stock market. How far down does it go before the cynically, you know, the good news is bad news doctrine takes over, or bad news is good news, I should say. And people say, wow, this is really, really horrible for the entire planet. That means it's not just the U.S. Federal Reserve. It's all the central banks around the globe that are going to simultaneously start conjuring money out of thin air and using them to support financial assets. Oh boy, you know, let's just drive the S&P up to 4,000. For that reason, I have some small puts. Definitely don't want to be short the S&P. I don't dare to do that. I am holding some S&P puts now as a hedge in case we get that nosedive on the panic. But I that's a very small bet. My bigger bets are on crude oil, a market that I understand better, and one that I think crude oil is a lot less immune to the realities of this situation. If this pandemic goes global and people are scared to death to get on an airplane and fly internationally, you know that the demand for jet fuel collapses. And that has to affect the market. The price elasticity of oil is, which is probably maybe a little bit of a technical concept, but what I'm getting at is it only takes relatively small changes in demand to cause big price moves. And if we see a collapse in demand as a result of the pandemic going global and nobody wants to get on an airplane, of course OPEC is going to respond to that. Of course they're going to cut production. There's a bunch of things that are going to happen. But initially, there'll be a panic sell-off to a very buyable panic low. Some people think that panic low is already in. They think right here, right now, this instant, at just a couple of cents below $50, actually 50.01. It just came up from 49.99 to 50.01 as I was speaking there. They think this is it. $50, baby. That's been the support level that's held for like a year and a half, 2 years now. This is your buy the dip opportunity. Don't miss it because it won't last. I disagree. I think there's a bounce coming now, and I think we get to a lower low if and when this goes global.
Does that take out a lot of the shale producers?
I don't think so. I think that what will eventually, the most shale producers are, for the most part, pretty well hedged. They've sold forward futures contracts. Their forward production is hedged for the next year or two.
Okay.
I don't expect, you know, what would really take out the shale guys would be if we had a sustained period of low prices that persisted. Now, that's possible. If this really, really got bad, let's say the worst imaginable case is that it does go global. You've got to have this global quarantining of people like happened in China. But it turns out that even that 24-day incubation period is short, and you know it's actually a six-month quarantine. Well, first of all, you can't do a six-month quarantine because the whole world would run out of food before you could get there. So you'd have to have some exception to that. But let's suppose that somehow this disruption of the global economy lasted for 6 or 12 months. In that case, yeah, it could really damage the shale industry. But if what we get is a V-shaped bottom in oil prices that then recovers, shale guys are no dummies. They've already hedged their forward production. They know that, you know, they can ride out a short V-shaped bottom. They're already hedged for that, and they potentially know how to roll their hedges so that they take advantage of that volatility that exists in the market. So I'm not too worried about the demand for oil going away in the long term. The demand for oil is going to be disrupted. And the reason that it has so much impact on prices, George, is it's all about physical logistics. For anything else, you know, if we're talking about S&P shares, well, you know, if there's too much of them, somebody who's got deep pockets can buy some and, you know, put them in a safe someplace. If we're talking about crude oil, it physically fills up tanks. Once you get to the point where all of the storage tanks are filling up, the next choice is something called floating storage, which means chartering these big tanker ships that are used to deliver crude oil, but not using them to deliver crude oil, just parking them, using them as big floating gas tanks just to store oil in because the gas tanks on land are already full.
Wow.
Once you get to the point where those are all full, now you've got to shut in production, and it really, really becomes a problem. So what can happen very quickly is if you have a sudden collapse of demand, all of the oil that's already on its way to ports in tankers, you know, they get to the port, they're ready to deliver it. Well, the expectation was while that ship was underway, the storage tanks that are there in the shores of Houston, Texas, are getting drawn down by refineries that are producing all kinds of gasoline and so forth. If the demand for gasoline collapses because everybody's quarantined and nobody can use it, all of a sudden those ships are all showing up. They're still full of oil. The tanks are filling up. Now you got to start using the ships as floating storage. It gets ugly quickly in terms of the logistics involved. And because of the lack of available storage capacity, spare storage capacity, prices can collapse in a situation like that. But they don't, the long-term price never collapses. If you look at the futures contracts, it's just that front month price, the price of the contract that says you have to accept physical delivery of this oil this month. That's the price that crashes. If you say, well, this is great, it's a bargain, I want to buy crude oil for delivery next December, you know, a year in the future, that price never crashes. It stays up where it was. It's just the contracts that are for immediate delivery that you can really only buy if you've got a tank to put the oil in. And as soon as nobody's got a tank to put the oil in, that price crashes. So I think that's the risk, is that it's called a super contango when you have a very, very low spot month price, but really all of the longer dated futures contracts hold their value. That's what I would expect to happen if we had a global collapse of demand.
Okay. Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. That's incredible insight. And I want to make sure that the viewers and the listeners kind of understand why I dig into this stuff, because I always talk about how, just me personally, I like to have my portfolio compartmentalized into insurance, investments, and speculations. And the investments, to me, the way I define it, is it has to pay me to own it. So the reason I like really getting into the nitty-gritty about this stuff is because there is a portion of my portfolio, or I think everyone's portfolio, that should be allocated to speculation, meaning you're only buying it because you think the price is going up or down. But I think it should be a very small portion, at least for me. It's a much smaller portion of my portfolio. But just to clarify for anyone out there who's going to write me a comment saying, George, this is against your investment strategy. So I want to be cognizant of your time here, but if you don't mind, I'd like you just to kind of revisit that stimulus, because I think that we're living in a world right now where the central banks play such a huge role in not only the monetary policy, but also the psychology of the market. So do you have any other thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do have quite a few thoughts on that. So something that I have predicted for years now is we're going to see a paradigm change in this whole central bank stimulus model. The way that this has worked so far, and this goes back to Ben Bernanke in 2008, is we had the great financial crisis, the 2008 stock market crash. Ben Bernanke comes up with this strategy that says the central bank basically creates money out of thin air, money that didn't exist until they pushed a button on their computer, and magically they can create money from nothing. And they use it to buy United States Treasury bonds on the open market. Well, who are they buying them from? They're buying them from institutional investors. What's the result of that transaction? Institutional investors end up with cash in their pockets. They could go and buy some other U.S. Treasury bonds, I suppose. But as they do that, they're bidding up the price of those U.S. Treasury bonds more and more. And by the way, that's exactly what Bernanke wanted to accomplish, was to bid up the price of those Treasury bonds in order to reduce the interest rate, the yield or effective interest rate, bringing down borrowing costs to stimulate the economy. That was the whole idea. Well, what happens is it puts money in their pockets. What do they do with that money in their pockets? They use it to buy other risk assets, specifically the stock market. And that has inflated asset prices dramatically. And it's gotten to the point now where we have an entire generation of professional traders who have just been brought up on this idea that that's how things work. You know, that that's the basic backdrop of how the market works. Is central bankers provide stimulus through quantitative easing and it drives asset prices ever higher. It's the reason that we've had the biggest stock bull market in recorded history over the last 10 years. And it's also the longest bull market in recorded history because, you know, it seems like it just can't stop going up. Well, what they're not thinking about and what they should be thinking about is what happens when central banks continue to conjure money out of thin air, but they don't put the money in the pockets of institutional investors by buying bonds on the open market. What happens when they start using that money for something else and it doesn't go to support asset prices anymore? Well, what would bring that about? I have predicted for years will be a political change where I think the political left in particular is going to say, hey, it's an election year. Let's tell our prospective voters this story, which we know is going to resonate for them, which is, look, your central bankers for 10 years now have been literally creating money out of thin air. And what they do with that money is they give it to rich people. And it pushes up the stock market for people who are fortunate enough to be invested in the stock market. But the average Joe on Main Street ends up getting screwed because it dilutes the value of your money so that they can give that money to other people, rich guys, the 1% who don't deserve it. Right. Now, there's some flaws in that pitch, frankly, in terms of their factual accuracy, but let's leave that aside. It sure sounds good. If you're the prospective voter, the guy who's, you know, driving a forklift and working hard to earn a living to support a family, and you're hearing that these central bank people, whoever they are, have somehow the magic ability to conjure money out of thin air like a printing press, and they're giving it to rich people, they're giving it to the 1%, they should be giving it to me. So I think you could see a political revolution occurring in the United States, and not just the United States, but around the world. Some people call that helicopter money, which is a reference to a speech that Milton Friedman...
Bernanke?
No, I'm sorry. People attribute that quote to Ben Bernanke. They think he made it up. Mm. Ben Bernanke was quoting Milton Friedman. And what's throwing me off is just recently, AOC, she got this Milton Keynes thing. And so when I say Milton Friedman, it's like, wait a minute, did I get that wrong? No, I'm just thinking.
It's so far, it's so stupid. Now it's even screwing us up.
If you know the real guy's name, you're like, wait a minute, it's not Milton Keynes, is it?
Milton Keynes,
Milton Friedman, the guy that AOC was confused about, is right. The guy who originally said, you know, worst case, the central bank has the ability to print money, put it in the back of a helicopter and just drop it out of the helicopter over cities. Ben Bernanke was actually quoting Friedman when he said that in 2002.
Okay.
So the latest twist in this story is that there is an idea that's been around since the 70s called modern monetary theory. And although it's not a new idea, it has become popularized, and particularly with Bernie Sanders and AOC and some of these progressive liberal Democrats are really looking and saying, look, there's an economic basis for why we ought to just do a whole lot more of this central bank money printing, as they call it. It's not actually printing dollar bills. It's creating money in electronic accounting systems. So it's not printing with a printing press, but it's basically money printing. If we're going to do that, we should be spending that money on Main Street, not on Wall Street. I've been predicting that for years. Now, what if, and there's reasons that they can't do that technically for the Fed, the central bank, to directly monetize government spending is illegal. Doesn't mean they can't change the law, but it's illegal for now. Well, how would they change the law if that's contentious and a lot of Republican lawmakers would be opposed to that? Enter a crisis. So what happens if this were to turn really, really bad and you had massive hardship and medical facilities becoming overwhelmed? What if the coronavirus crisis, if it becomes one, again, I'm not predicting it necessarily will, but if it did, what if that were the crisis that politicians latch onto and say, this is our opportunity. We need to use the central bank's ability to conjure money out of thin air, and we need to use it to basically provide a huge amount of disaster relief funding that will be directly monetized, that when they pass the law, they'll say it was just a one-time thing because of this crisis right. that had to be done, but they'll conveniently write the law in a way that it stays on the books and it allows them to continue to directly monetize a whole long list of things that aren't actually associated with coronavirus, starting with forgiveness of college tuition, free tuition for new students wanting to attend university, universal basic income, healthcare for everybody, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So I wouldn't be surprised if this gets really big. And again, I haven't predicted that, folks. I know people are going to put those words in my mouth. I'm saying there is a risk of that happening, which is not being accurately discounted by markets. I'm not predicting it has to happen, but I think there's a very real chance it could. If it gets really, really bad, I think this could be the crisis that lawmakers use to change the rules and make it possible for central banks to directly monetize government spending without having to impose taxes to pay for it. And that's going to change the game completely. The ramifications of that in finance are hard to even get your head around.
Yeah. How does that play into the conversation that you recently had with Russell Napier? And for those who are watching or listening to this, make sure that when you get done with this, you go over to Macro Voices, you download the podcast, and start listening to Eric's interview. I think it was maybe 3 or 4 weeks ago with Russell Napier, who is just top shelf. But he, you guys, your conversation was based around MMT really starting in Europe. And what Russell was talking about is them having to come in with a lot of capital controls. So do you see that potentially playing out in the United States as well, meaning MMT and therefore capital controls?
Well, I think that regardless of whether there's a coronavirus disaster or not, eventually, you know, we've got, and I just interviewed Chris Cole today. That'll be on this week's Macro Voices Thursday evening. You know, Chris Cole is one of many voices saying eventually we're going to have a pension crisis. It's unavoidable. There's right. going to have to be massive government bailouts to solve the pension crisis and the entitlement crisis. You know, Social Security being underfunded for 4 decades. All these things are going to come to a head in the next 10 years. And when they do, it's going to create an absolute financial disaster. And all they can really do, I mean, you can't possibly increase taxes on the rich enough to solve these problems. The way you can sort of solve the problems, at least in the short term, is to monetize, basically print a whole bunch of new money, create money out of thin air in order to fund a whole bunch of government relief programs in order to bail out the pensions and the entitlement programs and Social Security and Medicare and everything else. That dramatically increases the national debt. It devalues the value of fiat money. It means that gold goes up dramatically in price, and it ultimately will lead to consumer inflation someday. We're at some point going to get to a major inflationary backdrop, right? For the last 10, plus years we've had a deflationary backdrop causes most young people in finance to not even think inflation is possible. Inflation is insidious, folks. It's right when you think it's least possible, it's when it sneaks up on you. Hasn't yet, but when it does, we're really in trouble because once you get to a runaway inflation problem, you can't solve it because all the known cures for runaway inflation is you very dramatically and quickly raise interest rates. If you raise interest rates with the national debt where it is now, you bankrupt the government immediately. You right. can't do that. In fact, before he died, Paul Volcker, the guy who raised interest rates and famously squashed inflation in the late 70s and early 80s, Volcker himself, before he died, said that would never work today because of the debt overhang. So it's a whole new ballgame at that point. I think that's still several years away. But eventually, you know, it could be that a crisis like this, the coronavirus crisis, maybe provides the catalyst that's a turning point in that evolution to eventually more debt monetization and more monetization of government spending.
Yeah. Okay. So do you have time for one more question?
You bet.
Okay. Thank you. How do you think the Orwell ties in to the coronavirus? Do you think there's any, not necessarily correlation, but do you think that the Orwell the reality of the Orwell can be pushed to the forefront because of the coronavirus? Or do you think that there's any cause and effect there?
Well, first of all, for the benefit of any newer listeners who haven't listened to our previous interviews, yeah. George, when you say the Orwell, you're not talking about the book from 84. But I have used the phrase the Orwell to refer to what I see as a future government-issued digital currency. Do I think that the coronavirus crisis would directly enable that? Probably not. I don't really see why. What could happen, I guess, worst case, is we may get to a situation if there really were big lockdowns and if you had quarantines and so forth, maybe you don't want people, let's suppose that people in the greatest need, you know, literally can't buy food to feed their family with, and they're going to starve if they can't go to work. And governments have to do something to bail them out. And that something is they have to go wait in a line with a whole bunch of other people who might be sick at a government office to get some kind of benefit. Boy, if you could make that happen online somehow, that would be better. But frankly, there's easy ways to make that happen online that have a lot of security risks in them. So they might be a bad idea, but there's relatively easy ways to implement that pretty quickly, you know, with a website for getting, you know, what are essentially a type of welfare benefit.
Right.
You might, if you were a digital currency advocate, you might, after the fact, point to this and say, look, if we'd had digital currency where it was possible for government to transmit money directly into people's electronic currency wallets, they could have solved this without having to have people go and infect other people standing in line someplace.
Yeah.
Well, I guess that's an argument, but.
Yeah. What I'm thinking is just they look back and say, if the Fed could have taken interest rates to negative 5%, this could have propped up the economy. But unfortunately, they couldn't do that because, we have this stupid cash. And if we only would have had the Orwell, then it could have solved all our problems.
I certainly would agree that when governments push to abolish and outlaw cash, which they want to do for a completely different set of reasons,
right.
they will point to all crises in recent memory and come up with a way to spin it for how in the coronavirus crisis, if we could have done this, if we had banned cash before this, it would have been better for this and that and the other reason. Negative interest rates in order to provide stimulus without encouraging cash hoarding. Yeah, maybe, but I don't think that that this crisis, no matter how bad it gets, it's not going to last more than 6 months. I mean,
right.
Worst case, if it just nobody can get any help and the medical systems are overwhelmed and you just let it run through society, and that 1% fatality rate means 1% of all of the population ends up dying. That's what happened in the Spanish flu crisis in 1918. Was about 1% of the world population died of the Spanish flu. If that happened, which is the worst imaginable case with coronavirus, where you just couldn't do anything to contain it and it had to run its course, it's still going to be over in 6 months.
Right.
So I don't see it as persisting long term. I certainly think that anytime you have a crisis and people experience hardship, politicians will find a way to spin it to justify changing the rules, taking away liberties and rights, and it's necessary in order to fight terrorism and coronaviruses.
Yeah. And I just want to take a quick moment to plug your book. If anyone hasn't read Eric's book on digital currency, you've got to do that. I know it's on his website. I think it's on Amazon as well, or the audio versions on your website, and they can get it on Amazon. And what's the name of the book, Eric?
The book is Beyond Blockchain. Right. And the best place to find it, just go to macrovoices.com/BB for Beyond Blockchain. That page has, you can read the first chapter for free. I think you can listen to the first chapter for free too. You can buy the audio book, you can buy the paperback, you can buy the Kindle book. You know, it's all in one place at macrovoices.com/BB. And definitely check out the Macro Voices podcast as well.
Sure.
Chris Cole coming up this week talking about the volatility trade and optimum portfolio construction. Fascinating interview, although that one is really targeted more toward professional investors.
Yeah. So just lastly, for the average Joe, if they listen to this, watch this, and they want to take, you know, they don't want to freak out, but they want to take some precautions just in case we have a worst case scenario, what would you suggest they do?
First thing to do is watch all of Dr. Chris Martinson's right. videos at peakprosperity.com. A lot of people are really on his case, calling him a fearmonger and a crazy guy and so forth. If you listen to what he says, he's not fearmongering. He's trying to tell you what is the worst case, what's the worst it could get, and what you can do to prepare yourself. He talks about the N95 masks and these face masks that a lot of people call it a surgical mask. It's kind of like a paper blue thing that ties on your head. They're basically useless for preventing you from breathing in the virus. Okay. But they actually do have a lot of value. And this is something a lot of people have missed. The number one way that you're going to get this virus is from touching something with your hand and then touching your face. And it happens subconsciously. Most of us don't realize it, but we touch our face hundreds or thousands of times a day. If you've got a mask on, even if it's a mask that won't stop the coronavirus from passing through it, if you're breathing, you know, somebody has sneezed in your direction, those little paper masks, unless they're N95 rated or higher, they're not going to stop the droplet transmission of coronavirus or the aerosol transmission. So they're not going to protect you in that way. But what they will do is they'll stop you from touching your face, which is the number one way that you're going to get it. The other thing is just wash your hands as many times as you can possibly remember to wash them. Anytime that you go outdoors or particularly in a public place and so forth, wash your hands, carry the little hand sanitizer that you can carry with you. Use it as if you have obsessive compulsive disorder. You know, it's not going to hurt you to use it. If you overcompensate and this whole thing turns out to be a great big false alarm and you spent a grand total of $10 on hand sanitizer that you used over and over again 20 times a day, you're out $20. It's really not a big deal. And it potentially could, you know, make a life and death difference if this thing really takes a turn for the worse. So I'd say Martinson's videos are the place to start. If you want to go a deeper level of understanding on the science of it, some of it is well over my head. Dr. John Campbell, C-A-M-P-B-E-L-L, in the UK, he's got a YouTube channel where he gets into all of the, you know, the ACE2 receptors and the science of how this thing spreads and why it spreads and so forth. I don't know if he's an epidemiologist or what his background is, but clearly knows what he's talking about. Dr. Eric Ding on Twitter, DREICDING, is an epidemiologist from Harvard University who's done lots and lots of threads on this. Seems to be a very knowledgeable guy. He's worth following. and what else? I guess, don't panic. There's no reason for anybody to panic. That never does anybody any good. I think it's time to be concerned. I think it's time to be prudent. And particularly with respect to Chris Martinson's message on that video that he did on the 31st of January is probably the most important Chris Martinson video to watch. Is the one, it's the title of it is something along the lines of why the U.S. government just declared an emergency. That's the one where he talks about the China Academy of Sciences paper from the 29th of January. And his video is dated the 31st of January. That's the one where he makes the claim, and this is what everybody picked on him for and called him a fearmonger, is he said, look, if China has figured out, based on this scientific analysis, that the only way to contain this thing is to impose quarantines and keep people in their houses, that's the reason that, you know, there's a picture in the video of a store with empty shelves and panicking shoppers and everything. His point is not to panic anybody. He's saying, look, where you live right now, how much is it going to hurt you to just go to the store and fill your shopping cart extra full, fill your freezers up with frozen food, have plenty of canned food, have, you know, rice and beans and things that don't spoil, that there's no reason that I can think of that a coronavirus would cause your power to go out. But just in case it did and you didn't have, you know, electricity to cook with, have something that you could survive on for a while, you know, just a 10-pound bag of rice and a bunch of cans of baked beans or something, you know, will keep you alive. And some drinking water and some basic essentials. It's probably not necessary. You probably laugh afterwards and say, I listened to George and this wacko guy talking about something that never happened. Laugh it off. What's the other side, though? What's the cost of not taking action if it turns out that what happened in China happens where you live? I know it seems unthinkable. It was unthinkable to the people in China a couple of months ago. Okay, right. It's happening to them. And the humanitarian conditions in China are unthinkably bad. It's just horrible. It's probably not going to happen where you live. But what if you could take very, very small steps just on the level of stocking up so you fill your shelves in your house with as much food as fits on the shelves? You're going to use it someday. Save you from having to go to the grocery store next month. It's not a big investment to make that little change just in case what happened in China happens to us. I'm not saying it's likely, but it's plausible and it's something that nobody's prepared for.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. Well, Eric, thank you again for your time. It's always awesome to get your insights on these things. And I can't wait to do it again.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.